check out our new NBA show, Beyond the Arc, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, where you can find me, John Gonzalez, NBA insider Bill Reiter, and Ashley Nicole Moss 5 days a week talking all things NBA. Whether you're looking for insightful discussions, upbeat commentary, breaking news, interviews, or coverage of all the biggest stories in the NBA, our new show is the place to be 5 days a week. Download and follow Beyond the Arc on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
It's the Late Show Pod Show with Stephen Colbert.
My next guest is a musical icon who has sold over 300 million records, has 5 Grammys, and is both the Rock and Roll and Songwriters Hall of Fame. Please welcome Elton John. This is for you.
I know.
This is for you. Elton John! Elton John! Now, Elton John, thank you so much for being here. This is going to be slightly difficult for me because I'm going to geek out at you extremely hard. When I was in third grade, I had a band called Nebula 5. There were only 3 of us in it. I was the lead man, Gray Motzinger on drums, Tommy Whittle, who went by Tommy London in third grade on piano. We did all Elton John songs. I was an Elton John in eighth grade. At 8 years old, I was an Elton John tribute performer.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, it's you got the new box set here. It's called Elton John Diamonds, okay? It's got every
Elton John. It's the very last of the greatest hits packages you'll ever see.
And, it's the greatest of the greatest hits packages.
Yeah, it's got everything on there. And I came up with the title Diamonds because, you know, I like diamonds.
Well, there it is. You're Elton John. You get to name it. Now, you got the Diamonds out. You're on tour. You're still performing in Vegas. You work with the Elton John AIDS Foundations. You're raising 2 sons. What is it like for a pop star now to have 2 young sons? Is it cut into your cool at all?
No, it's just changed the whole landscape of our lives. I never thought I would be a dad, and it came to pass, and my children will be 7 and 5 very soon. And it's just the best thing that's ever happened to me. I've had so many great things. I've been so blessed during my life. I had a great career. I got sober. I met my husband, and the career's still going. But the greatest thing that ever happened was having the children, because it takes the focus away from me.
Now, Diamonds, specifically said, is celebrating your 50th anniversary of songwriting partnership with Bernie Taupin. How did you guys meet?
God, it's funny. I was in a terrible band. Not a terrible band, but a mediocre band. And I was getting fed up with playing to people who are eating fish and chips and in a cabaret thing. And so I thought, what can I do? And I saw an advertisement from a record company that said singers and songwriters wanted. And I'd written a couple of songs for the band, and we recorded them. And I answered the advert. And when I look back now, I was kind of chubby. I was very shy. I wasn't the lead singer. I was just the piano player in the band. But I was so fed up. And I went to the office in London. It was Liberty Records. I went in there, and it was hundreds of reel-to-reel tapes. There were no cassettes in those days. This is going back into sepia. This is in the late 60s. And there were piles of envelopes. And the guy behind the desk said, what do you do? I said, well, I can sing and I can write songs, but I can't write lyrics. I'm hopeless. So he said, well, why don't you just take this envelope? And he went through a pile of envelopes. It could have been any envelope. Talk about kismet. He gave me an envelope, which was sealed. I took it back on the tube train or the subway. And I opened it and I read it, and it was burning. It could have been any envelope. I mean, it was just, that was the envelope he gave me.
Did any of those poems become songs?
Absolutely not. No. they were very nice. I found them lovely, and it was the 60s. They were very esoteric and very flower-powery and very sweet. But I wrote melodies to the songs, and I liked them. And subsequently, we got a songwriting contract with Dick James, who published The Beatles. And it was a long time before we made it, but the 3 years that we were struggling
but when you
was
made
great
it,
back.
Boy, did you make it? Because if I'm not mistaken, your first album was?
The first album was Empty Sky, but the first breakthrough album was Elton John with your song on it.
So okay.
That was 1970.
1970. Then there was Don't Shoot Me, I'm Only the Piano Player.
No, there was Tumbleweed, Madman, Honky Chateau, Don't Shoot Me, Goodbye Elevate Road, Captain Fantastic, Caribou, Rock of the Westies. There you go.
Wow. Oh, how many?
In about 5 years.
5 years.
And separate singles as well. If we did Philadelphia Freedom, Pinball Wizard, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
And if I'm not mistaken, again, correct me, it's your life, but I understand that Goodbye to Yellow Brick Road was the first album ever to go platinum before it was ever released. It was just went platinum.
I have no idea about that.
That's my understanding.
Well, I know that Captain Fantastic was the first album to come in at number one, but I had no idea about Yellow Brick Road. But
it's
you know what?
Good.
We were
good
so busy and we love what we were doing so much that we didn't really pause for thought. We're having so much fun. And when you have that adrenaline and when you have that impetus and you're successful, we were like kids in candy stores. So we just love what we were doing. And that helps.
Well, the new collection of collections here is Diamonds. It's got stuff like You Can Tell Everybody This Was Your Song, Hold Me Closer, Tiny Dancer, Rocket Man, Honky Cat, I Remember When Rock Was Young, Daniel My Brother, Saturday, Goodbye to Yellow Brick Road, Seems to Me You Lived Your Life, Benny and the Jets, Philadelphia Freedom, Island Girl, Someone Saved My Life Tonight, Don't Go Breaking My Heart, Sorry Seems to Be the Hardest Word, Little Genie, Diamonds, Elton John.
Up next, Brandi Carlile.
Check out our new NBA show, Beyond the Arc, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, where you can find me, John Gonzalez, NBA insider Bill Reiter, and Ashley Nicole Moss 5 days a week talking all things NBA. Whether you're looking for insightful discussions, upbeat commentary, breaking news, interviews, or coverage of all the biggest stories in the NBA, our new show is the place to be 5 days a week. Download and follow Beyond the Arc on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to A Late Show. My next guest tonight is a 6-time Grammy Award-winning singer and songwriter. Now she's written a memoir called Broken Horses. Please welcome Brandi Carlile. Hi, Brandi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing fine. I'm really happy to see you.
It's really good to be with you.
Now, you won your 6th Grammy this year. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
In the actual award ceremony itself, you also sang one of John Prine's songs in memory of him. And after John died, you played the next day on our show, Hello in There, which is a song I don't know how anybody can get through, let alone the day after a man like John just died. So hats off to you. And the last time you were on this show, live and in person, you were playing with John Prine and Sturgill Simpson. I associate you with John Prine. What was it like being friends with him?
Man, being friends with John Prine was like being friends with like a prophet who makes you laugh, you know, as well as sort of foretelling the human future. He was really special, really special, really fun and really humble man, but brilliant.
You've written so many beautiful songs of your own, and now you've written, I'll say your first memoir, because you're still so young, but your first memoir right here, and it's called Broken Horses. How is writing a book different than writing a song, other than the fact that it doesn't have to rhyme? What's the challenge here for you?
Well, when I started writing it, I didn't know if it was a book or a song or just an essay, but it just kept coming and it just didn't stop. And I started realizing, well, this isn't 3.5 minutes. This is something else. And it was a stream of consciousness. So I guess it felt easy or it felt like it was coming from a muse somewhere. Mm-hmm. But it was hard after it was over to stand behind it because it's really hard not to have all that metaphor to wrap yourself up in and hide behind. And I'm still dealing with that right this second.
Well, what made you want to write it now? What was the motivation for a memoir, as such a young person?
Well, I've never really sat down to write a song, and I guess I didn't really sit down to write a book. But I wanted to write my experience with my faith journey and faith trauma as a queer person, and the way that that played itself out, and as a teenager with my baptism story. So I started out writing my baptism story, and I realized I just wanted to keep going.
Well, tell me about that baptism story, because I'm fascinated by it, and also the way you held on to your own faith in the light of it. Do you mind telling that story to the audience?
Yeah, absolutely. When I was a kid, I was involved in like a Baptist church, and my dad's words, not mine. My dad used to always say, "Baptists are mean, Baptists are mean." He didn't want me to be involved in it because I think he knew that, you know, that the rug might get pulled out from under me. But I really loved it. And I decided to get baptized, and I went up to the front of the church and I declared that I was ready for this to happen. It's like Baptists are kind of big on public accountability. So we scheduled my baptism, and I went to all these classes, and I was really young. I don't even remember, probably 16, something like that. And the day of my baptism, the town was there, my parents were there, and the pastor pulled me aside and told me right before it was about to happen that he wasn't going to do it because I'm gay. And it was just one of these things where I don't know if it was supposed to be a shock or if he thought that something was going to get denounced or that there was going to be some kind of repentance moment or whatever. But it just turned into this movie of me like running out of the church in front of everybody that I loved and being really humiliated. But I don't think I ever really felt accepted by any of those people until that moment. So really beautiful things came from that trauma, and I've been able to sort of hold on to and maintain my faith in spite of and maybe because of that day.
When you say maybe because of that day, what is it about that moment or that reaction from your community that led you closer to, for lack of a better word, the Lord?
Well, I think like a lot of queer people have a lot of big, deep spiritual trauma, but they also have these really intense understandings of spirituality, maybe more than other people who haven't been traumatized by it, because it's like doubt leads to faith in a way that, you know, questions lead to answers. But like your faith can get really intimate and really beautiful when you quite literally cut out the middleman, when you're rejected by a church or by clergy. There's no one between you and the, you know, and the unseen.
One of the things that I'm jealous of a lot of musicians because of their talent and the magic they can do, but also like your friendship with John Prine, I'm also a little jealous of your friendship with Joni Mitchell. That is another spiritual leader right there.
And, I don't blame you. Oh yeah.
Oh my God. We have a photo here of the night that you met Joni Mitchell for the first time. And that expression, on your face right there, I have.
Call that zero chill.
I'm getting a contact high right there, just looking at that photo. And then here's another amazing photo. This is you. Where is this? This is you backstage with Joni Mitchell. Where is this?
Oh, that was the night I did the whole Blue concert. I covered the entire Blue album beginning to end.
This blows me away in terms of an act of just raw courage, which is the people at home who don't know, Joni Mitchell has an extraordinary album called Blue, and you performed the entire thing one night in Los Angeles, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was a full house, and you and other musicians on stage performing for her. You performed one of her greatest albums to the master herself. Where did you find the courage to do it?
Buddy, I don't know. I had to get hypnotized to do it. And I mean, I'll tell you what, I was so terrified. But I lost it all. I walked out on stage and I went, "I am on a lonely road and I am traveling. And I look up and I just see the whites of Joni's teeth. And she's sitting next to and holding hands with Elton John. And I was like, this is what's happened to me in my life. This is where it's come to. And I just, all the honor just took over the nerves, and it became like my greatest, I think, musical moment.
Coming up, Tegan and Sarah.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And guess what? So are we.
Just in case you forgot, I'm Tori Deal. I'm a 6-time finalist and a Challenge champion.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira, and I've been gracing your screens for the last 2 decades. I am a veteran challenger and Challenge All-Star.
And speaking of All-Stars, All-Stars 4 is finally here.
I'm going to be honest. I literally thought this day was never going to come.
Well, the Challenge gods have answered our prayers, and we're going to be right here along with you fans covering every episode on the podcast.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, redemption seekers, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
Anyone can win, relationships matter, and only one all-star will claim the title of Challenge Champion.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
My next guests tonight are songwriters and musicians who have sold over 1 million albums. Now they've written a memoir called High School. Please welcome Tegan and Sarah. Well, you guys have been songwriters for, how long? 15, 20 years?
Hundreds and hundreds of years.
Yeah. Okay, so about 2 decades, something like that.
Yeah.
Now you have written your first book?
Yes.
First book.
That was published.
It's called High School, and I like it. It's got this basically high school bathroom quality mirror on the front.
Yes.
And why write this? Because you just wanted to relive those happy years?
So Tegan and I are twin sisters. We grew up in the 1990s. Uh-huh. We started our band in the 1990s, and we wanted to write our origin story. And our origin story, yes, please, go ahead. Yep.
Yeah. Little Nirvana.
It's real. It's real.
Oh, I believe it. No, I think I went to school with these girls.
Yeah. That is. We got a little, they don't, it's sort of like your passport photo. Like, they don't really want you to smile in Canada. So they're just like, look serious for once. But
oh, really? Oh,
a little
okay.
bit.
That's
yeah.
a know that. That
no, it was yeah. a choice. But yeah, we wanted to write our origin story because those years, actually this year specifically, that's grade 10 and we're 15. Oh. And we started writing our first songs at 15. So we wanted to write that story. And then, it wasn't just a music memoir. It really started to be about our identity as twin sisters and as songwriters, as creative people, and also, hold on, we're queer as well. So we cover that as well. It's like, it's all of those things. It's a lot to cover in a book.
Sarah just came out, you guys. Sarah just came out. It's you're very brave.
I finally said it.
As twins,
yeah.
People who aren't twins like me have these ideas in their head that twins kind of have a special twin language and things like that. Did you come out to each other first, or did you tell other members of your family or friends and only sort of wonder what was going on with the other sister?
That was part of the reason why we wanted to write the book, because for 20 years we've been telling the story, and I feel like people don't believe us, but we didn't ever tell each other. Sarah carried on these relationships behind closed doors. I obviously was suspicious because I was always like, Sarah and I, we shared a best friend, and when Sarah started sleeping with said best friend, I was no longer invited to the sleepover. So I was very like, what's happening behind this closed door right now? And I was like, get a life.
Yeah.
You know?
It was tough. So we, yeah.
Who was actually born first?
I was.
So you're the older sister.
Yeah.
But more immature. You know, she found her identity later in high school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sarah was more advanced. She's trying to be a jerk, but it's actually true. She was more advanced.
She's succeeding, actually.
She was very advanced, and I felt very left out. And we really want to tell that part of the story. I think when you hear queer stories, they're always really like positive. And then when you hear people meet us, they just are like, "Oh, it must have been so great for you guys. You must have been best friends and confided in each other." And I'm always like, "No, we hated each other. We used to beat the crap out of each other all the time, and we never talked to each other." I only found out Sarah was gay when we wrote the book.
That's not true. That's not true. That's.
Like the index.
This is like a
true.
Bit because we lie a lot in the
on
book.
That one, yeah, sure
it's
that's
not
case.
True.
What kind of songs were you writing in high school? So what were those? You said you were in these girls right here.
Yeah.
No, uh-oh. They didn't. They didn't talk to each other and they beat up on each other. But right there, but they're writing songs together. What were the songs like?
I think in a way, we talked about ourselves to each other in music.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I would write a song, and I think it gave Tegan an idea of where I was at mentally, emotionally. We just made an album of songs that we wrote when we were 15, 16, and 17.
Is that what this is?
That's what that is. That's like all songs we wrote in the 1990s.
Hey, I'm Just Like You.
Yeah. And there's songs like Don't Believe the Things They Tell You, They Lie.
Or like We Don't Have Fun When We're Together Anymore. I mean, you know, things that young people can say that adults would never say to each other.
Oh, I know those feelings. Yeah. I know those feelings.
Yeah, I think you'll like the record. You might, you know.
Did any of the stories in here surprise your parents? Were they shocked by any of the stories in here?
Okay, we did a lot of LSD. I feel like I'm coming out to you in so many ways right now. Like, I want you to like us, and I want you to think of us as, like, responsible people. So, full disclosure, we don't do LSD anymore. But we did experiment with drugs and alcohol, and my parents, like, loosely knew that. We would say jokingly, like, I took acid in high school, but my mom was very disturbed by how much we did it.
How much are we talking here? And at any point did you think you were a bee and tried to force yourself through a keyhole?
No.
Because that's what I was told in high school.
Really?
Yeah, I never did acid, but they said if you did acid, my teacher, Mr. Paff, said if you did acid, you're going to think you're a bee and try to force yourself through a keyhole, and you'll have head-turning scars the rest of your life. For what you do to your face is you try to force yourself through a keyhole.
I would have been like, that sounds rad.
Yeah.
What we were told was that the LSD will build up in your spine, and then you
can't be an airplane pilot.
What?
That was what I was told.
That was not what I was going to say.
That's what I was told. Like, I was like, somebody saw that picture of that kid and was like, ma'am, you cannot be an airplane pilot if you take LSD.
You two got off easy. You got told you were going to become a bee. You weren't going to be a pilot. I got told that it would build up in my spine and I would get like
flashbacks
and maybe like lose my mind. Like, actually, and then I think our mom told us we might, you know, if we ever tried LSD, we would jump through plate glass. That didn't stop us. I don't know. We did it like 50 times.
Can I say one thing for my mom?
Say something for mom.
Oh, God.
Mom.
Oh, my God.
Asked us to publicly talk about the fact that we did experiment with drugs. And it brought us closer together. We had a difficult relationship. We had fun when we were on drugs. And we replaced
such a narc.
We replaced that bad habit with music. We did. We learned to love each other and have fun together playing music. And we stopped doing LSD.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. So your message is, kids, don't do LSD or drugs forever.
Forever. Don't do it for like a year.
Don't do it. Thank you for listening to The Late Show Pod Show with Stephen Colbert. Just one more thing. If you want to see more of me, come to The Late Show YouTube channel for more clips and exclusives.
Check out our new NBA show, Beyond the Arc, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, where you can find me, John Gonzalez, NBA insider Bill Reiter, and Ashley Nicole Moss 5 days a week talking all things NBA. Whether you're looking for insightful discussions, upbeat commentary, breaking news, interviews, or coverage of all the biggest stories in the NBA, our new show is the place to be 5 days a week. Download and follow Beyond the Arc on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast wherever you get your podcasts.